How about we kind of ask the question that we've kind of been, circling around for a while in terms of the terminology that is more appropriate than pseudoscience and why it's so important to use proper terminology for this.
First, the term that I use is low value practices, LVP for short. Low value practices comes from the medical literature. So you can look back, and over the last couple of last decade or so, I would say this term has gotten some use, and it'll show up in different ways, right? Low value practices, low value care, low value treatment. We tend to adopt the low value practices one because it's general enough and it's in the way it's framed. And practices is a little more neutral than care. It's a little more broad than treatment. And so low value practices is where we went. So what the heck is a low value practice? I think that's more important than why we chose the term. Well, a low value practice is any practice that meets one of four criteria. I'm going to walk through those four briefly. And the first criteria is that it doesn't have the evidence necessary to be used. Period. We're not talking about there is some evidence out there that's good and some evidence out there that says it's not as good as another one. No. This is the evidence isn't there. And this can look two different ways, right? This can be an unvalidated treatment or a novel treatment. Right. Unvalidated treatments mean that this thing's been around for a while. It's been, well, not necessarily, it's been around. And there either is no evidence suggesting that it is effective for what it claims to do, or there is evidence suggesting that it is not effective for what it claims to do. I think balanced literacy is going to fall into this category, right? There is good evidence out there that balanced literacy is not effective for what it claims to do. So that's the first criteria, is it is it lacks supporting evidence. Sorry, my kids are having a ball downstairs, it sounds like.
No problem.
The second category is that it is less effective or efficient than a than another approach, another practice that aims to do the same thing. Okay. So a good example here, and I'm just going to keep picking on balanced literacy tonight because that's a fairly safe target these days. They have their benchmark assessments, and yeah, their benchmark assessments do track things, but they do not track things as well as, say, the MAP or the Dibbles 8 or Arcadia or whatnot, right?
Right.
And so we have a good sense of, yeah, okay, maybe this tracks them to some extent, and maybe that's better than nothing, right? I have my doubts, but maybe it's better than nothing. But we can't say that it's the one you should choose because there are others that are more effective, right? And so, when we basically the second criteria is comparative in nature, it's relative. So we're going to take the practice we care about, look at other practices that claim to do the same thing, and simply ask which one does it better. And that's the goal. It has evidence that says it's equal to or better than other competing options. Okay. The third criteria I think we can all get behind, and this one is that the practice is harmful or unnecessarily harmful. We have to be careful about saying that it's harmful, and we should never use anything that's harmful because one look at the medical side of things, and you can see that there are some harmful things that we need to keep around, right? Harmful in this sense means that it is going to cause more harm than good, right? That do the least harm principle that we always talk about in medical fields is violated when we talk about this third criteria. Balanced literacy might fall into this category, right? We know that when we use balanced literacy, kids are unlikely to succeed in reading if they were at risk to begin with. And so we are denying them exposure to an evidence-based intervention. We are using up resources from the school, from public funding, for a practice that isn't going to work. We are potentially making reading aversive in some situations. So we have to be really careful about how we define harm here. I don't just mean someone has experienced physical pain or illness in some way, or some other physical sense of harm. I'm being a bit more broad here. Harm can be physical, it can be psychological, it can be financial, and so on.
Right. As
And
I
so,
hear you describing this, you're really describing standards of care in a
yeah,
medical
I'm
practice.
talking about standards of care. That's right. And it
Right.
makes sense, right? We borrowed low value practices from medical literature. So low value practices was itself based and to some extent on standards of care. The fourth criteria is that it's simply not necessary. And this is one that's a bit harder to get your head around. My go-to example, the go-to example for the papers I've read has almost uniformly been the same, and that's the Ebola outbreak from a few years back. When that occurred, there was a need for rapid mobilization of quarantining facilities, rapid mobilization of treatment facilities, and so on and so forth. But as that outbreak subsided, that mobilization and those resources were no longer necessary. And so continuing to spend that money to put those personnel in that place actually was not a good choice. It would have been considered a low value practice. And let's think about this in terms of COVID. I think right now we're seeing sort of a ramping down of services related to COVID. We can hope that in the next decade or so, we'll see this continue and we'll see fewer and fewer resources. And so low value practices would cover the situation where, despite something not being necessary, we're continuing to throw money at it. We're continuing to throw resources at it. We're continuing to do something that's simply not necessary.
Right. Okay. To me, this is all music to my ears. It really reminds me of what I used to rant about, to be perfectly honest. I used to rant about with Joseph about some of my expectations that I had when I was coming into teaching. I always wanted to be a teacher. I was kind of on a different path for a long while. And then when I came into teaching, what I expected from teachers college was really what you're talking about now. I was expected to be trained on methodologies and tools that were proven successful, and that there would be like a standard of practice to teaching, and a way of critiquing that practice and seeing that constant revision that I saw coming out of the sciences. I think if an engineering student or a medical student were to look at what sometimes passes as research or practice in education, they'd be shocked. And given how much money sometimes, like as you were saying, how much resources is put into practices that really haven't been vetted at all, I think the public would be surprised.
Like this goes back to my example earlier of the school that had 14 school-wide programs for behavior alone, right? I'm not saying those programs were on their own bad or low value practices, but I would argue that they should have chosen one, maybe two programs to implement, and that any others would have just simply been redundant. There's rarely a time when you would double up on procedures. When one procedure does what when one procedure should do the job. And hey, there are times when you're going to implement something and that procedure is not going to do the job. And the data can tell you that if you're collecting good progress monitoring data, really monitoring outcomes the way we would want in sort of a structured inquiry. I won't even say science, right? Just structured inquiry. And I think that's become part and parcel with education. So, we have some of those data. We can see if a program is or is not working. If it's not working, if it's not doing the trick, then maybe consider, modifying it, changing it out, getting another program in there. But if it's doing the job, why on earth would you introduce another one to do the exact same thing? Like, I find that wasteful. And I think that's why, well, I know that's why we expanded a bit on that fourth criteria of LVPs.
Right. And, not to belabor the term pseudoscience, because I think we talked about it quite a bit, but I'm starting to think that my listeners might be wondering, okay, so we have this new term and we can see why it's more effective, low value practices. But is there a time or a context where the word pseudoscience should still be used in education?
Yeah, I would think so. Look, here's the deal. I one of the reasons I framed low value practices the way I have and everything I've written and talked about so far is because I want low value practices to be at the practice level. This is at the behavioral level of what teachers are doing in the classroom, right? And behavioral here, I just simply mean what they're doing. You know, if they were being recorded and you watched a video of them, you could describe their instructional strategy by watching and listening to them, right? We that's all I mean by behavioral here. I'm not imparting any kind of behavioral philosophy on this.
Right.
Low value practices is focused on that level of what they do in the classroom. Okay.
Right.
Pseudoscience, on the other hand, is getting more at some of those theories and hypotheses and claims. And so it does still, I think, have value in the sciences and in how we talk about some, you know, the value of research programs, whether a program is degenerative or able to produce, you know, more knowledge moving forward, those kinds of things. And, you know, I'll refer interested readers to Boudry and Pigliucci again, because they do a wonderful job of advocating for the continued use of pseudoscience in that regard. But I think that where low value practices has, for me at least, and that's all I can really say here, is it seems better to me, is that it is so solely focused on, does this practice result in the outcome it's supposed to result in? Or does this practice cause more harm than good, right? It's really narrowing it down to this real world, real situation with the client, with the student in front of you. By doing that, it unmuddies the water just a little bit, right? I don't have to talk about, okay, so your argument for balanced literacy, and I'm gonna keep going back to that example, is, you know, is based in cognitive science and this idea of cognitive load and so on and so forth. I'm so sorry, my little girl's having a tantrum.
No problem.
Based in cognitive science and all of these things, if I invoke the word pseudoscience then to describe balanced literacy, am I talking about balanced literacy, or am I talking about those theories balanced literacy is based in?
Right.
And I think that it starts to muddy the water really quickly. And I'll give you another example that's even clearer. One of the really prominent ways that we've gone about diagnosing specific learning disabilities over the last 30 years is something called patterns of strengths and weaknesses, PSW. A PSW, they'll tell you really quickly, is based in strong cognitive theory, and they are completely spot on. They are completely right. It is based on the idea of the three stratum model. The three stratum model has been around since the early 1900s. It's been developed and expanded into the Kittelhorn-Carroll model. There's lots and lots of supporting evidence for variations of this model, and there's more growing, you know, in the cognitive science area where they're focusing on different models, but that still get towards some of the same ideas. The content of this isn't relevant for my example here. I'm just trying to lay the groundwork for this is a really well, long supported set of theories that underlie PSW. I can sit here and I can say PSW doesn't work. And I can point to six, seven studies that'll say exactly that. And I can point to zero that say the opposite.
Right.
But then a proponent of PSW can come along and say it's based in strong cognitive science. So if I call PSW pseudoscience, do I have to then turn around and call that 100 plus years of research and intelligence theory pseudoscience at the same time?
Right.
I think that's problematic, right? Because it's really easy for them to completely dismiss me at that point. Now that said, if I were talking about thought-field therapy, that's another example we've used here today. And someone says to me, "Well, would you say that thought-field therapy is pseudoscience?" I would say, "Well, yeah, but I'm comfortable with that one because the theory itself is pseudoscientific, right? The idea of energy fields around us that we can manipulate through touch and tapping." The idea of meridian points and so forth doesn't is actually in conflict with what we know about the human body and physics and so on and so forth. And so, the term pseudoscience has its uses and it is important and valuable, but I do think it muddies the water when we really just mean this thing you are doing does not work. Why do you keep doing it?
Right. So I think that that is like super valuable to the listeners. I think it's very important that the teachers look at themselves as practitioners. So yeah, I think it's going to be super valuable for the listeners to really look at themselves as being practitioners, because I know some teachers feel really overwhelmed being told now they have to actively engage in the research and be able to basically critique their own practices based on the research. And there's a lot of people that are very uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, well, it's
They're
a lot to ask. I mean,
yeah.
let's be honest, right? There are people who train for 10 plus years to be able to do that as their job. And I think expecting folks who haven't explicitly trained in that to do that in addition to their job it's mind-boggling that we think that's practical.
Right. And so I think even breaking it down just in that subtle way that the word low value practice does, I think it says, you know, there's a lot of different discourse that could be happening in the theoretical part of research. All the teacher really needs to be concerned with, and they really should be making sure that their administrators and the policymakers are the ones that are actively engaging in this, because it's more of their role than being the ones that are giving the resources and often setting the tone and the initiatives. They should say and hold their administrators and policymakers to the idea that in education, just like in medicine, we need to see certain outcomes. We should not be using tools or resources that do not produce positive outcomes. And like you said, even just looking at it across those four paradigms, about is it causing harm? Is there better tools out there that do the same thing? All of those things, I think, is actually reasonable things that a teacher could train themselves and ask for those training in order to have a good outcome in their classroom without necessarily being a researcher themselves.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I mean, if nothing else, I think it narrows the field a bit, right? It permits us to stop talking about, well, is the theory justifiable? And it simply goes to, I don't care if the theory is justifiable. Does it work?
Right. Because I think oftentimes the debate for a lot of teachers, even the ones that don't necessarily like identify with one group or another, not the acolytes I'm talking about your average teacher. Often they embrace the methodology that supports their philosophy as a teacher. If they feel like the education environment in their experience is too authoritative, and they really feel like teaching should be more about fun, they will just gravitate to methods that seem to be more engaging and fun. And then other teachers that are like, well, you know, we need to have certain outcomes, not necessarily that they know how to assess outcomes. They'll tend to gravitate to to methodologies that they're more familiar with, or things that seem like they're more, product based.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. There was a study some years ago, and if I can hunt down what it was, I'll share it with you later on. But basically, they took two science textbooks, and one was filled with well-validated theories. It was strong, had strong support from an evidentiary perspective. The other one was filled with things that just didn't really make a lot of sense. Things that are debunked in one way or another. And what they did is they had four groups, and they just had different covers. Right, they had a boring cover, and they had a really exciting textured color cover with lots of color. It was like a textured lizard, if I recall correctly. And what they found was that even when presented with the well-founded but boring cover, and they had the option of the exciting cover with the questionable information, they would choose the exciting cover with the questionable information. Right. So it is to some extent, a marketing issue. And if you think about it from the perspective of researchers, a lot of their jobs is, to study this thing and produce a paper. And we like to think of it from the perspective of, oh, they're in this noble pursuit for knowledge and truth and justice. And right, but that's not necessarily true. I'm not saying that's not there. But there's a professional contingency involved here where, their job really is to produce a paper and then produce another one a lot of times. And so, a bunch of folks who've produced some really reliable and useful knowledge, don't really have the resources or time to go around making sure those things get used.
No,
And
exactly.
so, when your time and resources are able to be put into that, then you can make a difference. And so, my comment here is, and I've said this in a paper, is, when a lot of the same strategies that Pracanis describes to sell pseudoscience can be used to sell good practices, good science, good, effective, reliable knowledge as we know it right now. And I think at this point, the difference really is, is it hype, right? Is it pseudoscientific? Is it hype? Or is it science communication? And I do think there's a distinction there that's based on the quality of the content being provided. And I think that's hard to get across. That's hard to market that idea. It's hard to get publishers to say, yeah, I really want to sell that science.
No, you're exactly right. And I actually think, to be fair to the education sector, this is a big problem in health as well. Like when you look at papers and studies done on how long it takes best practices to filter down and be disseminated down to the family physician level, it's decades. It's decades. So and you're dealing with an industry that are a lot more rigorous in how they have their standards of practice, right? So that I think this brings me to the next question, and then I have a few more questions from our listeners. We're starting to talk about the marketing part of this and the commercial part of this, and so what I'm wondering is, why does it seem, or in your opinion, why does it seem like low value practices are marketed so much better than high value practices?
And I think this is such an important question. I don't have all the answers for you. I don't. I'm going to go ahead and say up front that I don't have any good data to support what I'm about to say. But my hypothesis is that, if someone develops a practice that works, let's say a researcher develops a practice that works, they're not necessarily incentivized to get that practice into the schools, right? They've done their part. They've done the part that they're incentivized for. They may go around and do some talks because they're further incentivized to do that. both professionally and financially. But the mechanisms that would need to be in place to effectively market and promote and disseminate and train people to fidelity, all of those pieces, they don't there there isn't there isn't like a mark there isn't an Amazon of effective practice dissemination, and so the process of doing that is often left up to others. It's often done ad hoc through those types of trainings and books and resources published online. Sometimes they're free, right? Sometimes they're paid. I'm not knocking people for trying to get, paid here. I certainly understand that, especially in our current world and context. I'm not knocking that at all. And I'm not knocking these researchers. They have to do what's right for them in their current context. But I do think, there is a there is along with that, there is a certain belief of if it works, it'll make it. If it doesn't work, it won't make it. I don't believe that is entirely true.
Right.
I think that there is more faith amongst researchers who do this kind of work, who are trying to develop these things, that evidence will win out, that evidence will be convincing. But I don't I and I will fess up. I was in that camp for a good long while. Like if I just share the evidence with people, they'll change their perspective. And what I quickly learned is, well, I just wasted a lot of time. Because when a decision is made based on someone else's authority, someone's prestige, someone's social status, someone's policy, someone's emotions, data rarely enters into those unless it was there already from the other person. Data is not the driving factor of the uptake of that new practice, of that practice in whatever sense it is. And so we are effectively we're not matching the right type of mechanism to persuade folks otherwise.
Right. Okay.
Real quick, and I'll keep this short. I think one of the things we have to address here is the elephant in the room. It's not just how do we get these things implemented in the real world. That's critical and important. And yes, that's something we should be focusing on. But another question is, well, why aren't folks being taught this in the first place?
Right.
What,
That's my version of it.
right? Why do we have balanced literacy departments of education? Why do we have teachers leaving programs without knowledge of the science of reading? And I'm using that term in the lowercase sense, not in the uppercase sense.
Right.
I don't know the answer to that. I could speculate, but I would make enemies. And I think that's a problem as well, right? And I see this, just to be clear, this isn't an education problem in general. This is a psychology problem as well. I see it in my field all the time. And it's what we've started to call the science to pedagogy gap, right? We've long talked about the science to practice gap, but I think there's a science to pedagogy gap as well. And it kind of makes sense. Right. Faculty tend to hire other faculty who they can work with.
Right.
Faculty tend not to hire people who are going to fight with them every day over their beliefs. And I'm not trying to knock education programs, psychology programs do this. I would argue many types of programs do this. I think it's human nature. And so that's part of it. It's hard to provide folks with different viewpoints if those different viewpoints aren't on the field. Another piece of this is the people who are truly experts in these things, there's only a handful of
Right.
them. They can't be in every program, they can't be in every department. And
Right.
so it relies to some extent on dissemination, not to practitioners, not to teachers, but to trainers. And I don't know how well of a job, and I'll speak in psychology because that's what I know best. I don't know how well of a How good of a job we're doing at that part of it.
No, this is definitely something that me and Joseph used to talk about as well. I just felt like, the type of researchers and the amount of people that would need to be trained in order to have a really big impact in our field, we're just not seeing that. And a lot of times that, when we think about people that do research at that level, often, they can end up in an entirely different industry just by the nature of the level of research they're doing. So I think that our profession, the way it works, has got on so long without really having to address research and outcomes, that I don't even think they really recognize where it fits anymore. From inside schools right now, I'm seeing a lot of scrambling based on the new legislation, right to read, right? And there's a lot of people that really just don't know what to do. They've got so many resources and so much training hours into something, and it's from what their perspective is, it's being said that this doesn't work, but they don't understand what we're supposed to replace it with. And
Right. Well,
they
that's an
don't,
issue too. Yeah.
right? And they also don't, they don't know how that determination was made.
So transparency, you think, is an issue as well?
Oh, transparency is a huge issue. And remember, we're not, and I don't mean this as a slight or anything, because I'm a teacher, but we're dealing with a lot of people that tend to major in humanities and English and history. So when they're looking at these things, some of them don't even approach teaching as a profession that would benefit from research. They actually feel like this part of me and Joseph creating this podcast and calling it Pedagogy Non Grata was the idea that when we started bringing up research, when we in our early years of teaching, it was not welcome. Just the idea of research giving an answer in education was kind of rejected off hand, because there was this notion that teaching is basically an art, and that it's all about the connection between the teacher and the student. And science really, you really can't look at it scientifically. And
There's
that,
a contingent within psychology that feels the same.
right. And it's this idea that they almost look at it as being harmful, like we're going to end up looking at students and education like clients and units. And even when you bring up the notion of engineering and health, I really feel like, that they bristle at the idea that we would be like practitioners that are more clinical, instead of having the freedom to just be creative. And I'm not knocking creativity in the classroom. I feel like that's actually the place where new ideas will be made. I don't
Sure.
want the classroom to look like a clinic. Like, that's not what I think anyone is advocating for.
Right.
But I feel like anyone that's gone through, as you were saying, anyone that's gone through Teachers College knows that you're not really being trained in Teachers College, in a way that you're looking at outcomes at all. You're not being trained on the research at all. So,
Makes sense.
yeah, I don't blame teachers for having the notions that they do, because I just really don't think, there's any part of our industry, for the teachers that really puts importance on research and outcomes. Okay, so we have a few audience questions, and I think we've covered a few of these. So I'm going to skip down to the last two. And the first one being, should teachers be trying to diagnose learning disabilities?
No. Look, I could spend a considerable amount of time explaining why I think that school psychologists who arguably have the most training in the world to diagnose learning disabilities struggle to do this well. There are lots of reasons for that. I think that there are you've asked a question that just makes me want to like squirm in my chair, if I'm honest. I think that teachers have an important role to play in it, in identification. I don't want to in any way indicate or suggest that teachers aren't important in this process. But I'm not going to step into a teacher's classroom and explain to them why I think they could teach fractions better or how I think they could teach fractions better because it's not my expertise. I think that, and especially when we start talking about something as complicated and complex and frankly hotly debated as specific learning disabilities, we need to be as cautious as we can be in how we approach that. And so what role do I think teachers can play in that? I think that they are amazing sources of information. They may be the canary in the coal mine, right? So they're going to let us know when they have a concern about a particular student. They're going to be able to guide that assessment that needs to follow, right? If a teacher tells me, so and so is having a lot of trouble sounding out words, well, that's going to direct me in one direction. And it's a very different direction than if that teacher had said, yeah, they're having a lot of trouble answering questions after reading a paragraph. Right. Those are very different presentations of what could be arguably called the same thing, a reading disability, right? But very different ends of the continua there. And so there's no way that a school psychologist is going to have that level of background, that level of intricate knowledge about each individual student in a school. We've got to rely on teachers. But I think, and this is a crucial point, that this is a partnership in a lot of ways, right? Teachers handle the pedagogy, they handle the instruction, they monitor, their class of students, and they're able to provide that background knowledge that we simply wouldn't have if they weren't there. So they are critical and crucial to this whole process. But I think that there is a liability and a different type of expertise that comes into play when we start talking about diagnosis and educational classification, right? And there is a distinction there, right? Diagnosis we talk about from a medical model, educational classification within the education system, saying that they need special education services or accommodations or something along those lines.
I think that, as you said, the teacher is the person in the room all the time. They're the ones that can kind of
Right.
send up that red flag,
Right.
and sometimes be the one that can collect some of that initial data.
Well, I mean, and ongoing data, right? They're critical to the process throughout. I don't in any way want to denigrate what teachers do. I think that they are heroes, right? But I do think that there are different types of expertise, right? And they have a certain type of expertise that gives them insights into a student's development, their academic skills, their readiness, and so on and so forth. But then there are a different set of skills that are required to do that kind of educational classification. And there's a reason, right, that it's a multidisciplinary team when we all come together within the schools. School psychologists, bring their knowledge. Teachers bring their knowledge. Speech pathologists bring their considerable knowledge. OTs, administrators, and so on and so forth. And it really is a collection of knowledge that's necessary to do this. And school psychologists, speech pathologists, are particularly trained to do that classification component. There are lots of pieces to that.
So that brings us to the second question. Does the DSM make space for identifying specific learning disorders without a cognitive measure?
Yes, it does. So the DSM, the way it's framed in the DSM is really about identifying the primary area of concern. It wants to know about, to what extent is this individual experiencing unexpected underachievement? And this is a key term, unexpected underachievement. Effectively, the big question is, well, if they have unexpected underachievement and they don't have a litany of other things, right, that might better explain what's going on, one of which is intellectual disability, then we would say that they have an SLD. Okay. But I just said you have to rule out intellectual disability. Well, you can do that in a couple of different ways. If you have concerns up front that someone has intellectual disability, then you're probably going to end up giving an IQ test, right? But that IQ test is not to identify the presence of SLD. It's to identify the presence of ID. It's a rule out. It's not the same thing. It's not a positive diagnostic. It's a negative diagnostic. You're trying to say, okay, it's not this, therefore it could still be that, not that it is SLD. And then, there are what gets complicated very quickly, is that there are different models for identifying SLD. When we start looking across the board, basically that term I mentioned, unexpected underachievement, is interpreted in a lot of different ways. The IQ folks, the OG IQ folks from the 70s through the late 90s, they argued that, if there was a big difference between the IQ, that big number you get from an IQ test, and any area of academic achievement, math, reading, writing, oral language, whatever, then, and usually that difference was about 15 to 16 points, but it varied a little bit by district policies and some statistical matters. And then you could say they had an SLD in that area. Well, there are problems with that approach. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. We're kind of comparing apples and oranges. It's a bit like holding up. It's a bit like saying so and so did really great in the 500-yard dash, and they did pretty terrible in the gymnastics competition. So therefore, they have a learning disability in gymnastics. Well, didn't we know that just from knowing they did pretty terrible in the gymnastics competition? But aside from that issue altogether, I don't think it's fair to compare those two kinds of things. We're comparing apples and oranges. Psychometrically, and I don't want to turn this into a psychometrics class because, I want you to keep your listeners. Psychometrically, that becomes really problematic. And to say that we're measuring one thing well enough to put it up against something that we're measuring in a completely different way, is really problematic. It doesn't work. So that sort of ability achievement discrepancy has some issues there. And there are more, but I'm not going to go into the psychometric weeds. Patterns of strength, our response to intervention came rolling out, maybe thundering out is a good way to put it. The logic model is pretty strong. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say if an individual is not succeeding to the desired criteria, intervene. If they do not improve, then intervene more. That's really all RTI was saying in the beginning. And I mean, I like the basics of that, but I think we can all agree. And this is where I get myself into a little bit of hot water with some of my colleagues. I would say RTI is a low value practice. Ooh, why? It's a low value practice because, let me back up real quick. So let's leave a cliffhanger there for a second. Ability achievement discrepancy, that old OG IQ ability kind of model, is also a low value practice because it didn't work. It didn't accurately identify kids. All right, so it failed on that first and second criteria. It's unclear if it caused harm, right? And it certainly identifying kids who have academic deficits is necessary. So that last one didn't fit in, but it definitely meets two of those criteria. RTI basically was rolled out in such a way that general tier one instruction didn't change with the rollout of RTI. Tier two instruction was barely even thought about with the rollout of RTI, at least initially. It's getting better, but still, we're not really universally across the board providing good tier two. And I would still, again, argue that tier one really hasn't drastically changed. It's changing slowly in some places, of course, but that is a big target. And then tier three was, really what we had to begin with special education identification and services. There's some variation there, but you get the idea. And so, effectively they tried to fit this peg onto a square, and the round hole onto the square shape, and called it good. When schools weren't provided with the training, they weren't provided with the resources. So what actually is occurring and being called RTI in most places really isn't, it's not effective.
Right.
And teachers will tell you left and right that RTI is not effective. RTI is not effective. And I think we're judging RTI by its implementation, which is fair, right? I don't want to imply that that's not fair, because if we ask someone to do something and what we're asking of them is just above and beyond their training, the resources provided to them, the time in the day, right? Then we're asking them to do something that's not going to work.
Right.
So in that sense, we do have sort of this all this this struggling issue of implementation. And then the third one here is PSW, which shares all of the exact flaws as ability achievement discrepancy, but has a prettier name. And I'm being a little facetious, but it's kind of true. Because it's also about measuring apples and oranges and pretending we can compare them. It's just comparing them in different ways. And the psychometric studies, like I mentioned earlier, just universally negative across the board. So this kind of comes back full circle. Like, okay, well, wait, didn't you basically just say that every SOD identification process is a low value practice? Yeah, I did. The three primary ones are all low value, but for different reasons. I'm not saying that we should stop. I'm not saying don't do anything. I'm saying, let's figure out how to help these kids more than we currently are. Let's
Right.
figure out how to get them intensive interventions. The implementation, that's where the implementation is a process where you eliminate or reduce the use of low-value practices within a system. So the de-implementation of balanced literacy in the Northeast is really wonderful to see, right? That's going to help with this whole process as we see more science of reading finding its way into the schools. We see this also with other things as well. So your question was, does the DSM make space? Yes, it does. It 100% does. And there are wonderful papers on this as well by folks like Jack Fletcher and Jeremy Michiak, who've just done really wonderful work in this area. And I could obviously get on a soapbox here. I'm going to try my best and scoot that away from me. But the issue is that we've come up with a social construct called SLD, and it can be a disability in reading, writing, math, what have you, and effectively, we had the label, the diagnosis, the disorder, what have you, whatever you want to call it, before we had any idea of what it really was. It was the politically motivated term, really one of the, I'm not going to say the total reason, but one reason of which was to reduce the number of kids who were being identified as ineducable or intellectually disabled, mentally retarded at the time. And we saw this thing kind of pop up, and we saw folks like Scanlon and Kirk rush in and start to try and offer these ideas. And folks started, positing really early on, hey, I think this is a processing disorder. It's a processing disorder. Great. What's a processing disorder? What do you mean by processing? Because that's never been clear to me, right? Because it kind of comes back to this idea of a cognitive process. Okay,
Right.
well, what do you mean by cognitive process? Are you talking about like doing the math, or are you talking about working memory, or are you talking about executive functioning? It was, you know, we had this language that has sort of made space for these cognitive approaches. But you know, whether that's, you know, accurate or not is to some extent an empirical question that we don't have good data on yet. And
Right.
it seems like we should. I recognize that. But you know, it's hard to pin down this term. It's hard to get agreement on what a learning disability even is at its root, right? I mentioned unexpected underachievement. Is a learning disability just not succeeding academically in a subject area? Is that all it is? Or is it not succeeding and that being related to a deficit in a cognitive area, right? So, and depending upon how you, which group you look at, the way they define underachievement, academic underachievement, is different. And so effectively you have, you know, different groups of folks who are trying to all pin down the same term and using slightly different definitions. And
Right.
so you know, we've kind of created a quagmire, and it's easily, in my opinion, I will say it's easily the hottest and most controversial topic in school psychology.
Right. It has such an impact on the education system.
Oh,
We know the
drastic.
power of labor labels,
Oh
and
my
it
gosh,
We're
yes.
not getting right, like so. And if we're not getting labels right, there's so much potential harm in that. So you can see how it would be a very hot topic. And I would say it actually brings us full circle to our main topic, because that shows that the benefit of the simplicity of the term, low value practices. Because as a teacher, you really only have to look at outcomes. When it comes to trying to parse out the definitions of certain terms and, how to look at one perspective compared to another, are we comparing apples and oranges? All of those questions are interesting, and maybe the food for researchers. But I actually don't think, and I didn't believe this before, I really part of our objective was to kind of make teachers little researchers and maybe even a little bit of experimenters in their classrooms. But I don't think that that's necessary. I really feel like we just need to be a little bit more oriented around viewing our resources as tools and really having a close eye on what is being told to us about the outcomes of these tools.
And
And
I'll just say really quickly, Dan Willingham has a wonderful book on when to believe the experts, and focused on education. And it's just such a wonderful book that covers a lot of these topics in really plain language. So I strongly recommend folks to find and download, or you know, paper, digital, whatever your preference, find and get that book. It's wonderful.
right. No, I totally agree. And I'm gonna wrap up this conversation. I've really taken away a lot from this discussion. I know my listeners are as well. I think even more now that I'm in the particular assignment that I am, where I'm at a school where there's a lot more need,
Sure.
and I'm seeing what happens when you have a concentration of a lot of those diagnoses and a lot of those labels. So, because I've started with RTI, actually my second year of teaching is when RTI was rolled out in my school. That's the
Sure.
school that I met Joseph in, and where we kind of RTI is what kind of first sparked this idea that maybe we should look more into the research ourselves. And I can see exactly what you're saying about, RTI to me was a revelation at the time, because it had a different way of approaching the problems I was seeing in the classroom. But as you were saying, it's about implementation. And since then, I can see how so many schools have struggled with implementing it. And now that I'm in a school where, you'll get a class of 25 students and you'll have like 17 or 19 students with an IEP. And
Well, that's a big number.
yeah, it's a huge number. And you're talking about, multi diagnosis where you'll have like LD and ODD and a lot of things piled on top. You'll have some speech issues. And it's because, what we see in education is a societal issue. Sometimes we just kind of look at the classroom as being its own little space, but it's really a microcosm of what's happening in society. And there are the schools that would really benefit from us getting the right answers the most.
Right. And that's an important piece, right? No one is out here saying that if you use an evidence-based instructional strategy, an evidence-based treatment, an evidence-based assessment, no one is out here saying that it's going to work every single time. Right. And I think recognizing that is important. But you're right. Like if we approach this saying what's going to work the best for the most number of students, like that sort of policy approach, I think would have huge benefits for education, for students, for kids.
And teachers finding a way to
Teachers.
demand that where they're not qualified to deliver something, they don't. I think we're really getting to a place where teachers are being put in a position where they feel like they're the ones that need to make these diagnoses, or they're the ones that have to figure out how to deliver the resources that is best for the student. And I think that teachers need to understand that they're only one part of that puzzle, one part of that machine, and that we can empower ourselves through becoming familiar with the research as it pertains to practicing. And that's what I loved about the terminology low value practices. What we need to be more focused on the practice level, what actually works and doesn't work there. Because a lot of the bigger questions, the more theoretic things, not only do they got to get sorted out, the terminology needs to get more refined, and they got to get proven. And then even then, they got to be disseminated properly. A lot of these things aren't
Right.
disseminated or implemented properly. So until all of that happens, we need to look, what do we have at our disposal now, and what works the best?
Yeah. That's awesome.
Okay, I really appreciate you spending all this time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Thanks. Thank you too
I've had
for having me. I really appreciate having an opportunity to chat about this stuff.
Oh no, I loved every second of it, and I know our listeners will really appreciate it. I think it clarifies some of the things that we've talked about in the last few episodes.
Oh, wonderful.
I think it was perfect, and I really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thanks so much, Robert.
Okay, perfect. You heard it here, folks. We have Ryan Farmer, and we just talked about low value practices, formerly known as pseudoscience, if I can make a joke there. And I will see you next time, guys.
Practice is formally known as.
The practice is formerly known as pseudoscience.
Right.
Okay,
Have a
perfect.
good evening.
Thank you.